Hi, podcast listeners. This is another chapter in the ongoing serialization of Fates vs. Death Sunrise Hotel, a full-length novel that takes place in the Fates vs. Death universe. We'll be doing one chapter every other week, free on the podcast, or if you want to listen to or read the whole thing now, you can go to www.fatesvsdeath.com and buy the complete novel. When you buy the paper version of the novel, you'll get access to the complete audiobook that you can download in MP3 format. Fates vs. Death Sunrise Hotel contains some pretty heavy subject matter, including some sexual violence, so these podcasts are intended for mature listeners only. Fates vs. Death Sunrise Hotel, a novel by Brian St. Clair Kane. This story takes place in the world of Fates vs. Death, the role-playing game. One day after, Tina felt cold and numb when she woke up. Except for her shoes, she was fully dressed. She had no idea what time it was. She looked out the window. It was day, but she couldn't see the sun and the small bit of sky visible from her window. Manny, Joe, and Tabitha were asleep. Tina went to their floor's bathroom to piss and drink water from the cold water faucet on the pair in the sink. Then she went out into the hallway and pounded with all her strength on the door under which the Bible page had been slipped. Nobody answered. Back in the room, Tina got out one of her knives that didn't have poison on it. She found an old candy wrapper among the trash on the floor, and she scraped a pinky-sized blob of congealed blood from the carpet onto it. "What are you going to do with that?" Tabitha asked sleepily. "I'm going to Bleeder territory. They can do psychic stuff with blood. If this is Maricel's blood, they should be able to tell me where she is. You should come with me." "Maybe after breakfast." "Fuck after breakfast. Maricel is missing. Don't you care?" "Of course I care, but we don't both need to go down there. It's stupid for both of us to miss breakfast for no reason." "Fuck you," Tina said. She shook Manny and Joe to wake them up. "I'm going to Bleeder territory to see if they can tell me anything from this blood. Come with me."
"What time is it? Did we miss breakfast at the Islamic Center?" Manny asked.
"What is it with you people and your fucking breakfast?" Tina demanded angrily. "Our friend is missing. She might be bleeding to death somewhere, and all you want is breakfast."
"Okay, okay, shut up," Joe said. "We'll fucking go with you."
Tina hurried them on as they got ready. Manny went off to the bathroom and came back a while later with makeup on and his hair all done up. Tina got pissed off and said, "Jesus fuck, Manny, we don't have time for your tranny shit." Manny didn't respond. They walked to the subway. Manny and Joe balked about having to pay for fares, but Tina stared them down. Manny and Joe squeezed together in the turnstile, and Tina went through by herself. They were waiting for the uptown train when they realized that they didn't know where Bleeder Turf was. They knew it was uptown, but from the Bowery, that meant most of the city. They still hadn't figured it out when the train came, but they got on anyway. Tina stared at the faded subway map on the wall of the car. Some people had tagged it with magic markers, but there was nothing to indicate gang turfs.
"Hurry up and ask some people before we miss it," Tina told Manny and Joe.
"If we miss it, we can just ride the train around."
"That'll take forever," Tina whined.
They started moving through the train, asking the riders. They asked homeless people, people in business suits clutching briefcases, tired-looking men and women in stained work clothes who held metal lunchboxes, even a group of kids who looked to be around middle school age. Several stops came and went, but nobody had anything useful to say. Most just said, "Sorry," in a way that made Tina wonder if they were saying, "Sorry, I don't know," or, "Sorry, I don't help strangers." Tina forced open the heavy door at the end of the train car and stepped between the trains. The subway smell, like dusty basements, like machines, and like old campfires, was strong here, and the sound of the car moving in rushing air was loud. She pushed into the next car. At the end of the car, she saw a 20-something multiracial guy with 1 foot on a slipboard. He was wearing a baggy gray hoodie with the hood up and loose blue jeans. Pieces of leather were sewn to the knees and elbows. The leather looked pretty scuffed up, like it had taken a lot of scrapes. There was also a big scab on his chin. She made her way across the car as quickly as she could without running. He was probably a member of the Borders gang, and so he would probably know about gang turfs. He watched her approach. The train decelerated for the next stop. Tina had to grab a pole to keep from stumbling. The Border put both feet on the board, and the momentum propelled him through the train car towards her. The board left a thin trail of something shiny, like a snail's trail. When he got near her, he grabbed a pole and spun around it. He stopped facing the other way and waited. Tina figured that when the train started again, he would get on his board again and momentum would push him back to the other side of the car.
"Do you know where Bleeder Turf is?" she asked.
As soon as she started talking, a hand went under the hood and he removed an earbud headphone from one of his ears.
About 100 to 120th, east of 3rd Avenue. If you get off at this stop and walk a couple blocks east, you'll be right in the middle of it.
Tina's eyes darted to the open doors of the subway car. Here? Oh shit, thanks! She darted out of the doors and, ignoring the pain in her ankle, raced towards the doors of the next car, where Joe and Manny should still be. If she could get to the door and hold it open, she could stop the train from leaving until she could get Manny and Joe to come out. As she ran, she saw the doors closing. They'd closed by the time she got to the first door of the next car. As the train started moving, she banged on the windows with her fists. Manny and Joe looked out at her and stared stupidly, their heads pivoting to track her as the car accelerated past.
Fuck!
Tina said as the car disappeared down the tunnel. A few other people had gotten off at this stop and were quietly heading up the stairs, not bothering to look at her. Tina went and looked at the subway map on the wall. At the next station, the only train they could get on was a northbound, as opposed to some other stops where you could get on a northbound or southbound. If they got off, they could walk back 15 blocks, but in the time it took them to do that, they could stay on the train and make a full circuit. Tina decided they would probably do that, and so she sat on an old wooden bench, hugged her knees to her chest because it was cold in the subway, and waited. She looked at the layers of graffiti on the walls, trying to discern their meanings. After about 10 minutes, she grew impatient and decided it was stupid to wait for Manny and Joe because they might not come back. She left the subway and started walking fast. She was a bit nervous about walking into gang turf by herself. The Bleachers were a well gang, and Tina didn't know how protective they were of their turf. She worried that she might be mistaken for a member of some enemy gang, or that she might run into a gang member who was looking to pick a fight just because he or she could. As she walked, she started seeing red drop shapes among the graffiti around her. This part of town had smaller buildings than those in Midtown and Downtown, some as small as 2 stories high. There was a wider range of colors and architectural styles. The avenues were wide, but the streets were narrow and the pavement was in rough shape. There were a lot of trees in the sidewalks, their roots tearing up the concrete blocks. She saw a little coffee place, the name Mike's Espresso Express, printed on a faded yellow awning, and through the window she saw there were people inside. She went in and saw one table had 3 people who looked in their early 20s and who were all wearing a dark color of red. One guy had a red t-shirt and slacks. The other guy wore a red dress shirt, black belt, and red corduroys. The woman was wearing a loose-fitting blouse and a skirt, both made from some very thick, dark red material. The clothing made her look thick and shapeless. They were drinking coffee, eating bagels, and chatting. Tina walked up to them.
Hi, she said when they acknowledged her. Are you guys Bleachers?
There was a sudden tension. Tina wondered if she had somehow insulted them.
Yeah, what's it to you?
The woman said, a hard edge in her voice.
Well, my friend is missing, and I have some blood I think is hers.
I was hoping I could find someone who could help me. The group seemed to relax.
Your friend disappeared?
The guy in the t-shirt said, his voice surprisingly soft. Tina nodded yes.
And you found a bunch of blood?
Tina nodded.
And you brought it with you?
Tina nodded.
How old is this blood?
It's from sometime last night.
It hasn't been refrigerated or anything?
No.
Sorry, we can't help you. The blood is too old, the cells are dead. And even if it was fresh enough, you'd have a hard time finding someone willing to taste it. I hate to say this to you, but when people go missing in this city, they're usually dead. And none of us wants to taste the blood of a dead person. It's He looked down at his coffee and gave it a little swirl. An unpleasant experience.
So there's nothing you can do with the blood? Nothing at all? They shook their heads no. Then the guy with the dress shirt brightened and said to his friends,
You know, she could go see Hobo Pete.
They explained that there was a black market trader who did a lot of dealing in blood samples and had some sort of DNA testing equipment.
You might be able to find out if this is your friend's blood or not.
They gave Tina an address, warned her that it looked like a furniture store, but that the real action was in the back. It was only 8 blocks away. She dreaded the long walk, but as she walked, she found her ankle was much improved over the previous day. She still had a limp, but that she couldn't quite hide, but the pain was manageable. When she arrived at the address, the store was closed, and a handwritten sign on the other side of the metal shutters said it would open at 10. She didn't know what time it was, but she figured it would be a while until 10. She sat on the sidewalk by the shop and waited. As she waited, she thought about the sudden change and how she was living her life. Just a few days ago, all she cared about was where she could get a free meal, panhandling, and using whatever drug would fuck her up for the evening. Now she was actually on a mission, finding things out. She had been hoping for something to come along and test her so she could discover who she really was. She should think the test would be an attack, and she would pass the test by killing her attacker. Then she would know she was really the Blade Queen, that it wasn't just something she was pretending to be. This was not the kind of test she'd imagined, or ever would have wished for, but maybe it would have the results she had hoped for. A fat old Caucasian guy with long hair and a beard came out of a door to the right of the shop, and he started unlocking and rolling up the metal shutters that covered the shop's door and windows.
"Are you Hobo Pete?" Tina asked.
"Some people call me that."
He finished rolling up the gate, unlocked the front door, and went into the shop, motioning for her to follow. Tina stepped in. Something electronic chimed to announce her entrance. The shop smelled dusty. There wasn't much furniture, and most of it had dust on it. It all looked pretty old.
I have a blood sample. Some people said you might be able to take a look at it for me.
Come in the back room, he said.
She followed him to an office with a wooden table. On the table sat a computer with some unidentifiable shoebox-sized device attached to it. Taking up most of the space in the room were refrigerators with clear glass doors. They were full of hundreds of glass bottles of blood. Each bottle had a little plastic tube sticking into it, submerged into the blood, and every few seconds a bubble would emerge on the surface of the blood and burst. The room was very warm. He sat down at the desk and turned on his computer.
Okay, he said. Give me a sample.
Tina got the candy bar wrapper out of her pocket. As soon as he saw it, he said,
No, 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 no. I can only buy blood that's in a sealed, sterile container that's so fresh it's still warm.
I'm not trying to sell you the blood, Tina said. I was hoping... I was told you could look at the DNA. Tell me whose blood it is.
Well, yes. I can't tell you exactly who it is, unless it's somebody already in my database, but I can tell you general characteristics about the person.
Okay, Tina said, proffering the candy bar wrapper.
Hold on, young lady. I make a living selling goods and services, not giving them away. Do you have any money to pay for this service?
He pronounced the word money slowly, as if it might be an unfamiliar term to Tina. I have a few bucks.
He patted the shoebox-shaped machine. This thing cost me more than $1,000. I can't make that cost back a few bucks at a time. It will cost $75 for me to analyze your blood.
Tina touched the small wad of cash in her pocket, but the wad she had earned doing tricks and had planned on spending on drugs. She didn't have $75, and she needed to save some money to get home.
How about $30? She asked.
He looked at her.
$75.
I don't have $75.
Do you have anything to trade?
Not really.
How about your blood?
My blood? He nodded. To sell to bleeders? He nodded again. Couldn't they use it to hurt me or control me or something?
If you believe some of the stuff bleeders claim, they could. They exaggerate their abilities, of course. They'd be stupid not to. But even if they could hurt you remotely, which doesn't make a lot of sense, why would they? They don't know who you are.
But what if they want to practice? You know, practice killing people by remote.
He shook his head no. Most bleeders aren't like that. They're mostly pretty good kids. And besides, practicing attacking people using a blood sample of a girl they don't know would be like practicing knife throwing by throwing a knife into the darkness, if you get my meaning.
Well, I guess I could sell you some of my blood.
First, let's see if your blood is worth anything. Do you have any useful skills?
I'm pretty good with a knife.
He looked up at her and shook his head no. Sorry, honey, you're not. A good fighter, one who knows they can beat up or kill most anyone they meet, walks around with a lot more self-confidence than you do. What else have you got?
Tina had a look on her face like someone just slapped her. Then she forced her face into an angry look.
Are you fucking... He interrupted her. Don't bother getting indignant. Have you got any other saleable skills?
I'm a survivor, Tina said, trying to sound like she meant it.
I came to the city with no friends, no place to stay, and only a couple bucks in my pocket. I never lived in a ghetto before, and I had to teach myself how to stay alive. Okay, listen, sweetie, he said in a calm voice. I'm not saying that's not a significant accomplishment. I'm not saying it didn't take guts. But half the blood samples I have here, the people they're from could say the same thing. This is a city of survivors.
He got up and went to one of the cases and opened the glass door. Tina could feel warm, moist air roiling out from inside. He picked up a bottle, pulled it as far as the plastic tubing would allow.
This guy was from one of those fucked up African countries. He was part of some rebel group and was captured by the government. They spent a year trying to brainwash him. He made them think they had succeeded, had actually brainwashed him, but they hadn't. They let him go back to his rebel group to see if he could feed them information, but he fed them false information. He was a triple agent, see?
She glowered at him. So you're saying the fact I have survived here isn't shit? The volume of her voice rose until she was almost yelling.
Just because I didn't come from some fucked up African country, all the pain I've had to deal with and the dangers I've survived, they're not worth shit. No, sweetie, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that your surviving is not a quality which is rare enough to be saleable. Now, if I take your blood, it's only going to sell for aesthetic value. It'll sell to people who like tasting new personalities, not to anyone who'll be able to do anything useful with your blood. And that's not going to make much money.
She continued to glower at him.
Shit, sweetie, I wasn't trying to hurt your feelings. I'm just saying your particular strengths don't translate well into sales. Listen, let me take your blood. I know a couple of clients who I might be able to talk into buying some. That plus your $30, and I'll analyze your sample.
He got a rubber hose and a needle attached to a plastic bag. He filled the bag nearly full of her blood and put a band-aid on her arm.
Why did you take so much if you don't think it's sellable? Tina asked grumpily.
Maybe someone will take a liking to it and they'll make it part of their regular order. That's probably the only way this will become worth my while. Now let's see that blood sample.
Tina gave him the candy wrapper. he took a little knife with a rounded edge, scraped a tiny piece of coagulated blood off, and put the blood into a little indentation in a tray that ejected from the machine. He looked at the computer screen. "This isn't a clean sample. There's lots of different genomes in here. It's from a carpet that doesn't get cleaned often." In fact, Tina remembered it didn't seem too clean when they got there, and they hadn't cleaned it once since they moved in.
"Well, I'll just assume this common one is the one you're looking for." He waved his fingers at the screen. "Well, it's a male, I can tell you that."
"What?" Tina said, craning her head to look at the screen. It was a complicated screen with a bunch of green, black, and red numbers in a bunch of boxes. It looked like the time someone at one of the soup kitchens had sat her down in front of a computer to fill out a welfare form, and she couldn't figure it out. Not that she would have qualified for welfare as an underage runaway, but she wasn't going to tell the lady at the soup kitchen that.
"Looks like fairly pure Caucasian, brown hair, green eyes. This not who you thought it was?"
"My missing friend is a girl. Could there be two people's blood in there?"
"I don't know. There's a lot of DNA. If there's someone else's blood in there, it's a small amount. The overwhelming majority of the DNA in the sample is this guy."
"So could you, like, show me what the person would look like based on his DNA?"
"I don't have the software to do that. You'd have to go to someone who would charge a lot more than me."
"Shit. Okay, so brown hair, green eyes, what else?"
No major genetic disorders, so no Down syndrome or anything like that. No major disease predispositions. Small obesity predisposition, but that doesn't mean he's fat, just he's more likely to be fat. Male pattern baldness, but he might be too young to show, or he might have treated it with meds."
"Can you tell if there's any drugs in the blood?"
"Sorry, this machine doesn't do that."
"Can you tell how old the guy was?"
"No."
"Nothing else you can tell me about the guy?"
"He hasn't had any of the common genetic alterations. None of the legal ones, anyway. The software doesn't have the illegal ones in its database."
"So this guy could be 10 feet tall, glow in the dark, and have three dicks for all you know?" Tina asked spitefully.
"It's possible. You ever considered that your friend might have had a sex change operation? They don't change your DNA."
The thought shocked Tina for a second, but when she thought about it, she realized it wasn't likely. Maricel had been involved in a number of discussions with Manny about the sex change Manny wanted. She had been supportive of Manny, never acted like it was something to be ashamed of. If Maricel had undergone a sex change, she would have told Manny.
"Do you have anything useful to tell me?" Tina asked curtly. "Sorry."
"Great," she said. She grabbed the candy bar wrapper off the desk and stomped out. On her way through the showroom, she kicked a low wooden table with the heel of her boot, knocking it over. On the way back to the subway, she fumed about what an asshole the guy had been, insulting her, stealing her blood, and not giving her anything useful in return. Being angry was the only thing keeping her from crying, which she was prone to do any time anyone insulted her. She couldn't stop thinking about him saying her blood was worthless, that she obviously wasn't a skilled fighter because she didn't have self-confidence. The criticism hurt, a burning pain that she could not ignore. Yet she realized she now had extra reason to hope. The blood wasn't Maricel's, which meant she might be okay. Maybe she stabbed someone and was afraid his people might come for revenge, and so she went and hid. Maybe she would show up in a few days and say, "Has anyone been asking about me?" By the time Tina got off the subway downtown, the day had warmed up. It felt around 20 degrees more than it had been for the last few days. The sun shining on her shoulders and back made the walk back to the Bowery pleasant. Tina walked past several convenience stores and knew they would have breakfast burritos or hot dogs under hot lamps. Yet the blood testing and the ride home had used up all her cash. She thought about going in and stealing some snacks, but her ankle still hurt too much for her to try to run if a security guard tried to chase her. Tina limped around her neighborhood looking for bloodstains. As she walked, she noticed an old abandoned building that had a cross nailed to the door. The cross was made from homemade bandages stained red-brown with dried blood. It was a black med home, a place that someone who had just gotten hurt in a knife fight and didn't want police asking questions about what had happened might go to. Tina limped up to the door, which had broken panes of glass with large pieces of plywood attached to the back. She banged on the door. A tall, mixed-race young man with a baseball bat in his hand opened the door. Tina guessed he was a few years older than her, maybe 18 or 19. Tina asked if anyone had been brought in last night who had been stabbed. He said no. She asked if there was another black med household she could ask at. He told her the locations of three more black med houses within a few blocks. At the second house, a young girl of about 12 answered the door. She spoke with a lisp and told Tina the same thing. As Tina was walking away, she heard the door opening behind her. She saw a guy with a salt-and-pepper beard and a young man of about 14 come racing out brandishing shivs. Tina ran as fast as she could, her ankle hurting, and they ran after her. After a few blocks, she looked back and they had stopped. Tina stopped too, her side burning and her head swimming. She put her hands on her knees and panted, staring up at them. When she caught a little of her breath, she shouted, "What the fuck?" at them, while waving a knife threateningly.
"You attacked our grandma!" the kid yelled angrily.
Tina remembered the old black med she had run at when she was high on God Killer.
"I was just a little crazy that night," Tina yelled back. "I wasn't going to hurt her, really. I'm sorry if I scared her."
The elder man spoke.
I don't want to see you anywhere near my family again, you worthless addict.
They backed off, and Tina walked away, feeling like shit. Tina went to the third Black Mitt home. They hadn't had a stabbing victim either. Tina went back to the hotel to see if there were any street people hanging around nearby, but the streets were empty, as they often were in the Bowery. Tina went back to their room, and Joe, Manny, and Tabitha were devouring the fast food Tina had brought home for Marisol the previous night.
Hey!
Tina said angrily.
What?
Joe said indignantly. You want some? Tina ate a little bit, although she felt slightly queasy. She told Manny, Joe, and Tabitha that they should walk around the neighborhood, ask anyone they could whether they had seen anything. Tina warned them that they should split up to cover more ground, not go as a group. They reluctantly agreed. Tina went out, checking the remaining cash in her pocket, and walked north through the Bowery towards Drake territory. She walked past a liquor store with a couple of old, heavily battered pay computers out front. Hanging around the pay computers were a group of bored-looking crackers. One of them was a thin boy, about her age, with hair in his face. He smiled at her, showing missing teeth, and greeted her as she walked past. She returned the greeting, but kept walking. He walked alongside her, asking her name, where she was from, if she had a boyfriend. She asked if she needed to make any phone calls or access anything on the internet. For free? She asked.
Of course for free, he smiled.
She stopped and thought about it. Can you find out if someone called an ambulance from this neighborhood last night?
I can try, he said.
He cracked his knuckles as he led her back to the pay computer. He had fingerless gloves, and his nails were painted black. The others got out of his way and stood at the computer. He typed something in, and the pay computer company logo disappeared. Angry tribal music with heavy drums and orgasmic screams of song pounded out of the pay computer's little speakers, making the steel shell that encased it vibrate. The screen showed an underground tunnel. The perspective was moving as if the viewer was flying through the tunnel. Unidentifiable graffiti flew past with the tunnel walls. Suddenly the movement came to a stop and the view swiveled to show a tunnel wall. The graffiti on it looked like some sort of ancient magical symbols. He looked back at her and smiled.
You like it?
Yeah, she said. It's nice. In reality, she thought it seemed like a huge waste of time.
I can get here from anywhere I log in on the net. A whole virtual server with all my favorite hacking tools and everything.
Neat, Tina said. He started typing and many small windows opened up. They were filled with colored text on black backgrounds. It didn't look like the computer interfaces Tina was used to. It looked more like a book.
Hey, the cracker said as he typed, not turning his head. You ever heard of the Slow Dead Rave?
No, Tina said.
It's a club over in Hummingbird territory. They've got smart drinks that will blow off the top of your head. No kidding. I do CGI for their screen sometimes, and I can get in for free. Sometimes I can even get a few free drinks, especially if I've got a cute girl with me.
The other crackers next to them started to laugh. Tina looked at them, not quite sure what was so funny.
So maybe you might want to go with me some night, the cracker continued.
The other crackers continued to laugh.
Fool, an older cracker girl laughed.
Who you calling a fool? Tina asked defensively.
This ass, she said, aiming a playful kick at the butt of the young cracker at the pay computer. Give it up, Chad. You know you don't have any idea how to get into any ambulance computer system. He logged into AFF HelpNet, another cracker laughed, pointing at the screen.
Great, Tina said angrily. You know, this was really fucking important to me. Thanks a lot for wasting my fucking time. Tina stomped off. The young cracker tried to apologize, but Tina ignored him. In Drake territory, it wasn't long before Tina ran into a Drake. The Drake was sitting on top of an old mailbox with peeling blue paint. She had rolling papers on her knee and was rolling a cigarette. Tina had tried Roll Your Own, since they were cheaper than regular cigarettes, but she had never had the patience or the preciseness to do it. The Drake on top of the mailbox looked to be about 18 or so. She was of thoroughly mixed race, with deep olive-colored skin and high cheekbones. She had short, spiky black hair that stood straight up. Her fingernails were painted shiny green, but otherwise she had no makeup. She wore black jeans, a black hoodie which was too large for her, and fingerless gloves.
Hey,
Tina said, in a friendly tone. The woman looked up, flashing pretty, brownish-green eyes.
Hey,
she said. Her voice was smooth but rich. Tina couldn't tell, but thought there might be just a touch of an accent there. Tina told the Drake she was looking for a poison, something that she could put on a knife that would kill slowly and painfully.
Someone pissed you off?
The Drake asked.
A friend of mine is missing. I don't know what happened to her, but if I find someone hurt her, I'm gonna...
Take a pound of flesh? The Drake asked.
Is that some kind of Bible thing?
Tina asked, thinking of the folded-up Bible page in her pocket.
Don't know where I heard it, she mused, holding up the completed cigarette. Could have been the Bible. I've read that. You want a cigarette?
No, thanks, Tina said.
Probably smart, not taking a cigarette from a Drake. I could have put poison in it. Not that I would ever hurt.
She gave Tina an appraising look.
A potential customer.
The look made Tina feel embarrassed for some reason, but not in an entirely bad way.
I'm Althea, she said warmly.
I'm Tina, Tina said. Sometimes people call me Blade Queen.
So you want something painful and deadly that can be put on a knife. When are you planning on finding the person who did this bad thing?
I don't know, Tina mused. I'm still asking around, trying to figure it out.
All I know is my friend is missing, and there's some bunch of some guy's blood, and my neighbors heard some guy yelling at her. Althea lit up the cigarette and took a long drag. So your friend might be okay. Yeah, she might, Tina said. Well, I could sell you some Drake blood poison. It's a pretty nasty way to die. You pretty much die of a bad infection, burn up from fever. The problem is the poison is sort of like a cocktail with some really nasty bacteria and shit. Once the poison gets made, the bacteria start to die off, and the poison gets weaker. So you're saying the stuff has a limited shelf life, Tina said. Right. You'd have to come back for some fresh about once a week or so to keep it reasonably strong. Well, do you have something that's equally nasty that lasts longer? Not that's anywhere near as affordable. She bit her lip thoughtfully. Hey, I got an idea. A subscription. For, let's see, $20, you can come back once a week and get a free refill until you either catch the bastard or give up looking. What do you say? How do I know I'll be able to find you? Althea laughed. Yeah, like I might be in my beach house in Hawaii a week from now. Tina frowned at Althea, thinking that Drake might be making fun of her. Sorry, Althea said. I can see that you're serious. I'll tell you where I live. You can come over any time. My business is being here, selling poison, so I'm not going to be going anywhere. Most of the transactions I make don't have a lot of trust in them, Tina said. Poisons are all about trust, Althea said, hopping off the mailbox and standing close to Tina. All I give you is a little packet. How do you know if it's poison? I could sell you dust and snot and call it poison. And there's a lot of jacks and addicts out there who pretend to be Drakes and who do just that. The Drakes, we don't do that, though, because we know if we did that, then people would stop buying from us. All we have is trust. It's what we live on. It's the air we breathe. You trust me to give you poison every week. I trust you to tell me when your revenge quest is finished. She ran her fingers through her hair and scratched the back of her neck. She was close enough that Tina could smell her. She smelled musky and sweet, like a typical street person, but with an odd odor like this bitter smell of cut weeds. Tina felt woozy. She stumbled a little bit. Oh, I'm sorry, Althea said in a concerned tone, stepping backwards. I didn't do that on purpose. I swear. I just forgot. Do what? Tina asked, confused. The poison in my bloodstream. A little of it escapes when I exhale, and if you breathe it in, it'll make you a little faint. You poison me? Just give it a second, and you'll be fine. No long-term effects, I swear. I just... Sometimes I forget that if I stand too close to someone when I talk to them, someone who's not a Drake... I'm sorry. It's okay, Tina said. I've never been poisoned before. So, like I was saying, about trust. Yeah, sounds good to me. $20, I get Drake poisoned till I find my friend is okay, or I find the person who hurt her. Tina dug into her jacket and got out a small wad of cash. Althea went into the pockets of her jacket and pulled out a little packet of paper. She fumbled around inside another pocket until she found a ballpoint pen. She wrote her name down on the packet, Across Street and Green Door. Althea handed the packet over with a smile. Tina could see that some of her teeth had been filed down. They were not quite as sharp as the fangs people got on the black market, but they looked like they could pierce flesh easily enough. Tina handed over the cash in return. So just a thin coating of that on a blade, Althea said, and don't touch it, or anything that does touch it. And it's a good idea to wash your hands after you've used it, whether or not you think you touched it. For God's sake, don't touch your eyes or your mouth until after you've washed your hands. Got it? Okay, Tina said. As Tina was walking off, Althea said, Hey, Tina! Tina turned back. Did you check the morgue for your friend? It's in the basement of the city hospital. I hadn't thought of that, Tina said. Thanks. I will. Tina walked down to the subway and rode it up to the hospital. After wandering around for a while, she found the entrance to the morgue. She talked to someone at a desk who said that no young Caucasian females had come in lately. She asked about white males of any age. There had been a few, but they have died of disease or OD, not anything that would have left a huge pool of blood. Then Tina went to the ambulance bay. There was a tall Hispanic guy with graying temples loading stuff onto an ambulance. Tina tried to talk to him, but he said in a stern voice, I can't give you nothing. Tina left, disgruntled, wondering if the ambulance guy thought she was an addict trying to scam drugs or something. It was getting to be evening, and Tina had only eaten a little bit of old fast food. Tina limped over to the subway, squeezed in with someone, and got off at 23rd Street downtown. She limped down 6th Avenue, looking pouty and asking for change. To her surprise, people responded well to her limping. By the time she got to the Bowery, it was nighttime, and she had an extra $9. She stopped in a liquor store, bought a package of cheese crackers, a pack of cheap generic cigarettes, and a 40-ounce of malt liquor. Tina headed directly to the Mission. Manny, Joe, and Tabitha were waiting in line, and Tina slipped in with them. You guys find anything? Tina asked, giving them each cigarettes. Someone wrote something on the ceiling, Tabitha said. I hate you, I hate me. I wrote that, Tina said, disappointed. I'm surprised you guys didn't notice it earlier. They asked if Tina had discovered anything, and Tina said no. She did show them the packet of poison she had bought. They didn't seem impressed. She also flashed the 40 and promised she'd share it with them after dinner. No way, Joe said. Break that shit out now. So they drank the 40, trying not to let any of the volunteers see them. They finished it off quickly. Split four ways, it didn't do much for them. Tina felt only slightly buzzed. Still, the time spent waiting in line seemed to pass faster. They were only about 5 people away from getting inside when the volunteer came out and said, "Sorry, we're all out of food." The sun had set, and the sky was turning from dark blue to black. They walked over to a fast food burger place on the edge of the Bowery, and Tina bought them each 2 of the cheapest burger they had. They ate it as they walked back.
"You're suddenly in the money," Manny said. "What's up with that?"
"Don't know," Tina said. "I guess people think poor little limpy girl needs money." When they got back to the hotel, the others headed upstairs. Tina stayed behind and knocked on a few doors on the hotel's first floor. Finally, someone called through the door asking who it was. Tina called back.
"I'm Tina. I live in the hotel. My friend went missing from here last night. Can I talk to you for a minute?"
To her surprise, the door opened. A sickly thin black man was inside. He had a thick cotton shirt and old blue jeans on.
"Come on in," he said softly, a slight southern accent in his voice.
Tina followed him inside, closing the door behind her. The man's room was the same size as Tina's. It had a cot, an old easy chair with a red and white plaid pattern, a wooden shelf with a radio and a hot plate on it, some dishes and some old pictures of naked women from magazines thumbtacked to the walls. The thin man sat down heavily and sighed when he was in the chair as if he had just done some tremendous physical feat.
"Lock the door behind you, please."
Tina sat down on the edge of the bed. There was a bad smell in the room, a smell Tina associated with sick people.
"So what did you say your name was again?"
"Tina."
"Tina. Tina," he mumbled to himself. "Have we met? My memory ain't so good lately."
"It's the disease." Tina looked him over. He was so thin and fragile, and his skin was so loose, it was hard to say what his age was.
"Disease?" she asked. "Don't worry, girlie. It's not contagious. I got it from using needles. It's an HDNA slow killer. Not slow enough, if you ask me."
Tina was suddenly curious. She had learned about HDNA slow killers in health class in school, knew that unlike the more famous HDNA strains, they spread and killed slowly, not wiping out entire communities, but peppering the world with slow deaths. She had never met anyone she knew had one.
"How long have you had it?" "Oh, it's been about 3 years now since I started noticing symptoms. Doctors say I might have had it for 6 months before that without even noticing it."
"Are there drugs for it?" Tina asked.
"Well, you know, I'm on medical insurance, and they have stuff that they'll pay for, but that stuff hardly does shit."
"How long do you think you have?"
"Who knows? They might come up with a cure for my strain tomorrow, but it's hard to believe that after so many years, and with so many different strains out there. Medical insurance will pay for a cure, even if it costs $10,000, because it's either that or pay for a hospice when I'm too far gone to take care of myself."
"My mom died in a hospital," Tina said. As soon as she said it, she realized it was a stupid, pathetic thing to say. Embarrassed, she turned her head away and looked at the covers of his books.
"Were you here last night?"
"Yep."
"Did you hear anything? Any screams or shouting or struggle or anything?"
He thought about it.
"Well, there was the ambulance."
"There was an ambulance here last night? What time?"
"I'm not sure what time. I'd say it was about 9 or so. They used their siren coming down the street and everything."
"Did you look? Did you see who they picked up?"
"Sorry, kid, I didn't. You might ask Laszlo. He's in and out of here all the time. Maybe he saw it."
"Who's Laszlo?"
"Oh, you know, Laszlo. The guy who always goes and gets liquor and groceries and stuff for people who live here. He lives down the hall, the last room on the left here."
"I'll talk to him, thanks." Tina got up and headed for the door.
"Wait, hold on. You don't have to go right yet, do you?"
"Sorry, I really need to find out what happened to my friend."
"Yeah, I understand. I just get kind of bored sometimes. I used to read, but my eyes are going, and I can't do much of that anymore."
"Well, maybe later," Tina lied. "I can come back and hang out some more." He grunted to something that might have been a laugh.
"I won't get up," he said. "Just make sure the door is locked behind you."
"I will," Tina said. "Thanks." Laszlo, it turned out, was a slightly short, mostly Caucasian middle-aged guy with curly hair. He was friendly and acted like he had already met Tina. Tina mentioned that the neighbor said he was a sort of runner. He proudly explained how he got things for people in the building who couldn't or didn't want to leave the hotel. Mostly he got liquor, groceries, and hygiene products for people, though he hinted that he also got less legal stuff. Drugs and prostitutes were the only things Tina could think of. He said he worked for tips. He wouldn't say how much he made, but that it helped out in addition to the disability he received. Tina wondered about this. All the people she had met who got disability could afford real apartments. Supposedly, a lot of VR addicts were on disability, which meant the money from disability was enough to pay rent in a real apartment, for food, and for a VR subscription. Tina wondered where this man's money went. The smell of liquor in the room offered one explanation. After chatting for a while, Tina asked Laszlo if he had seen or heard anyone who had been taken in the ambulance. He said he hadn't.
She asked if he had ever seen anyone strange hanging around or talking to Maricel. Laszlo said he hadn't. Tina asked if there were any residents that he knew of who were violent or crazy. He gave her a funny look and said, "As far as I'm concerned, these are all good people." Tina ignored this comment, not understanding what he was getting at, but not wanting to seem argumentative by questioning him. Tina asked Laszlo if he knew anything about the guy who lived across the hallway from her who had slipped a Bible page under the door. Laszlo didn't know anything. Tina remembered the three dangerous-looking guys she'd seen in the lobby, and then on the stairs. "Do you know three guys who hang around here? One white and tall, one black with spikes in his head, one multiracial, kind of thuggish-looking?" "I've seen them, but I don't know who they are. I think they live here, but maybe they rent a room only once in a while. Some people like to rent a room here for their drug binges. I knew this one guy. I don't think he's from the city. He comes on weekends wearing a suit and tie. He asked me about getting God Killer." Tina interrupted. "Yeah, but these three guys, who do they know? Have you seen them talking to anyone who lives here?"
"Just the manager."
"Huh. Manager told me he didn't know them."
"Maybe I'm wrong then," said Laszlo, but Tina didn't believe him.
"Anything else weird?"
Laszlo thought for a while. "Couple days back, I was heading up the stairs doing a delivery, and there was someone on the stairs above me."
He gestured upward with his hands in a way Tina thought was redundant.
"I didn't see them, but I heard them. I was heading up, and they was heading up. And I got off on the third floor, but they kept going. It sounded like they were going all the way up to the fifth floor."
"So?"
"Nobody lives past the third floor."
"Are you sure?" He shrugged. "Maybe they were just going to use a restroom." He shook his head.
"Manager keeps them locked on 4 and 5. Doesn't want more restrooms he has to clean and keep repaired."
Tina thanked Laszlo and left the room. She went down to the lobby. The room stank of cigarettes. The manager was sitting on his stool in his cage, feet propped up, reading some VR movie magazine. It was the cheap kind you could pick up free in a pile at the subway station, printed on newsprint so thin it was almost transparent. Tina hadn't seen a VR movie in years, but judging by the cover, the latest big thing was some Freedom War epic where you got to choose whether the hero, a handsome young multiracial man with blonde hair, would choose the Freedom Army or the U.S. military. The manager noticed Tina but didn't put down the magazine until Tina said, "Hey." She asked if he knew anything about people up past the third floor, and he said he didn't. She asked if he never went up there to make sure nobody was squatting there. He said,
"Of course I do," sounding annoyed.
Tina asked again about the three dangerous-looking guys, and he said he didn't remember who she was talking about. He sounded like he was offended Tina had even asked the question, which made Tina suspicious. "They were young guys, not like all the apathetic old wino fucks that come in here. How could you not remember them?"
"A lot of people come in here wanting to know how much rooms are. I'll be fucked if I'm going to remember every single one of them."
"But they weren't talking to you about rooms. They were waiting for someone. Who were they waiting for?"
"Didn't I just tell you? I have no idea who you're talking about."
"I better not find out that you're lying to me," she said, pointing a finger threatening at him. He scowled at her. As she left, he said something to her about when the rent was due, but she ignored him. Tina went into the stairwell, where she could smell someone had recently pissed, and trudged her way back up to the third floor. In her room, on the small shelf, she grabbed a small dollar store flashlight, which they used during the frequent blackouts. Then she went up to the fourth floor. The place had the same dusty smell of the lower floors, but none the smell of food, cooking, and body odor, and cigarette smoke. She got out her flashlight and started shining it on the doorknobs. In the yellowish circle of light, the layer of dust on the doorknobs was clearly visible. Tina decided that there was nothing in any of these rooms that would be of interest to her. The bathroom was indeed locked, and the dust was just as thick on the bathroom door handle. Tina went back to the stairwell and trudged up to the fifth floor. This floor had two working light bulbs, so it was marginally brighter. It was odd to be on something that seemed like her floor but was darker and quieter. On her floor, except in the dead of night, there was always some kind of noise coming from someone's room. The walls had spots of dark mold. Someone had scrawled a huge "Fuck Chackie" in black marker. Tina walked up and down the hall, checking doorknobs with her flashlight. One doorknob looked relatively free of dust. She looked up and saw it was room 508. She tried the door, but it was locked. She knocked, but there was no response. She knelt, got out her lockpicks, and, holding the flashlight in her teeth, tried to pick the lock. After about 10 minutes, she managed to unlock the door. She put her lockpicks away, pulled out a poison knife, and slowly opened the door. The room was as tiny as hers, and nowhere near as cluttered, so it only took a quick peek in to check the corners and assure herself that the room was unoccupied. Tina entered quickly, closing the door and locking it behind her. There is no carpet in this room, only strips of yellowish-white linoleum with a print of yellow and pink flowers on it. The linoleum wasn't perfectly flat. It was slightly rumpled, as if installed by an inexpert hand. The walls had the same glossy yellowish-white paint as the other rooms, except cleaner. The window had black plastic bag garbage taped over with duct tape. The bare light bulb hanging from the ceiling was the same as that in Tina's room, but of a significantly brighter wattage. As in her room, there was a small tarnished radiator in the corner, connected to pipes that came out of the wall near the floor. The only thing in the room not attached to the walls was a metal cot with a mattress on it, like the one in Tina's room. Tina knelt to touch the mattress. It was covered with a zip-up slip cover that felt like plastic. The whole thing reminded Tina of the time she had gone with Marisol when Marisol got her tongue pierced. They had gone to a house that had some black men squatting in it, and they had been taken to what was once a bathroom. Instead of a toilet, there was a hole in the floor and a toilet-shaped depression in the linoleum. In the middle of the room was an office-style chair covered in clear plastic, which the black med with the Eastern European accent had asked Marisol to sit in. While Marisol was getting her tongue pierced, Tina tried to puzzle out why the black meds would want to do their piercings in a bathroom, of all places. After some thought, Tina had realized that a bathroom was probably the easiest place to wipe up any blood or other bodily fluids that spilled. The linoleum floor, the plastic bag on the window, and the slip cover on the mattress all put together made Tina shudder. It would be a perfect kill room, a place where someone could kill and then wipe up all the blood. Tina unzipped the mattress slipcover, but only saw an old mattress covered in gray canvas. She looked under the cot, but there was nothing there. When she was getting up, though, she noticed something on the loop of metal that the cot had in place of a footboard. The bar was rusty, but it looked like something had scraped fresh gouges through the rust and into bright virgin metal. She went to the head and found the scrapes on the metal bar on that side as well. The scrapes were deepest on the outside of each bar, facing the walls on either side of the room. Tina thought of handcuffs. Imagine Marisol handcuffed to the bed by her hands and feet, trying to pull her limbs free, the handcuffs digging into the metal bars and scraping off the rust, just as they must be digging into her skin. Tina let out a sob and her hand went over to her mouth. She tried desperately to think of another explanation for the scrapes, but couldn't. Tina got down on her hands and knees and scanned the rest of the room looking for any other clue. In one of the corners, there was something crusty in the little crack where the linoleum met the wall. Tina fished some out with the point of her blade. It looked like dried blood. Continuing to look, Tina found a tiny piece of black plastic stuck in one of the hinges on the door. It looked like it had been caught in the hinge and torn off of something else. Once outside, Tina concentrated her flashlight on the floor. Not only was the floor outside the door to 508 slightly cleaner than elsewhere, Tina could make out light reddish stains. She followed the cleanliness and reddish stains to the door to the bathroom. She imagined a bloody killer leaving the room to wash off, dripping blood on the floor, and then coming back to scrub the blood up. The bathroom wasn't locked. Cautiously, Tina entered and flicked the light on. This bathroom was much cleaner than any of the lower floors. There was even a roll of fresh toilet paper next to the toilet. Tina spent several minutes looking but couldn't find any evidence in the bathroom. She tried to imagine the kind of kit the killer or killers would have to bring. Soap, towels, spare change of clothes, handcuffs, and something to bring the body or body parts out in. Maybe thick black plastic bags, like the black plastic that she found in the door hinge of room 508. After leaving the bathroom, Tina checked the remaining doorknobs. Except for 508, they all had an even coating of dust on them. Tina went back in the stairwell and sat by herself on the top step for several minutes. She couldn't help think of all the horrible things that might have happened to Marisol if she had been brought up here. Tina sat for a while and wiped tears from her eyes with the sleeves of her denim jacket. After a while, when she felt a little more in control, she headed back downstairs. Joe and Manny and Tabitha were sitting around looking depressed and bored. She berated them for not being out trying to talk to someone who knew something about what had happened to Marisol, but she couldn't muster up her usual level of rage, and they could tell. She felt emotionally drained. They tried to talk Tina into hanging out with them, but she wanted to go harass the Bible guy. She sat down by his door and pounded on it for about an hour. The fat, effeminate guy, a few doors down, the one who had threatened to call the police when Tina was practicing with her lockpicks, popped his head out of the door and said, "Do you know what time it is?" angrily. Tina stood up quickly, forgetting about her injured ankle and wincing as she put weight on it. "Hey," Tina said with a hopeful, friendly voice, "my friend disappeared last night. Do you know anything about it?" "All I know is you've kept me up for the second night in a row banging on people's doors." "Yeah, but did you hear anything before that? A man yelling something? Please, I wouldn't ask if it wasn't important." "No," he said, exasperated. "I didn't hear anything. Now quit your pounding and let me go to sleep, or I'll go get the manager and get you kicked out of here." She yelled loudly enough that she hoped Bible Guy could hear her. "This Bible freak knows something about what happened to my friend, and he's not talking, so I'm going to keep pounding on this door till morning if I have to. And if you ever threaten me or say one word to the manager about me, I'll cut your fat gut open." Behind Tina, Manny and Joe looked out the door to see what the commotion was. He laughed. "Don't threaten me, kid. You're wasting your breath. I've been through way too much in my time to be afraid of a young gutter punk with a knife. And you're wasting your time pounding on Andrew's door. He's very, very sensitive, and the more you try to confront him, the more he's going to withdraw. Look, if you just go home and let me sleep, I'll talk to him first thing tomorrow, okay?" Tina stood and glared at him, panting through clenched teeth. Finally, she said, "Fine," angrily. She stomped into her room, pushing Manny and Joe out of the way, and slammed the door. Eventually, Tina talked Joe, Manny, and Tabitha into wandering the neighborhood, asking people if they had seen Marisol. It was late now, probably close to 10, but there was a smattering of people out on the street. There was a cold wind, the kind that made you want to keep moving to avoid being completely chilled. They wanted to walk together, but Tina told them they could get more done if they split up. Tina limped up to homeless people and people working behind the counter at liquor stores, the only businesses open in the Bowery this late at night. Nobody had anything interesting to say. Then she saw Manny jogging down the street toward her, weaving to avoid tripping over the larger cracks in the street. His long straight hair bounced as he ran, like something out of a shampoo commercial.
"Tina," he said half out of breath, "I just talked to the night manager for the Clifton."
Tina knew the Clifton was another SRO hotel less than 2 blocks from the Sunrise.
"He said a girl who sounds like Marisol came over there, evening before last, to ask about getting a room."
"Really?" Tina asked. "Fuck, what time?"
"She didn't remember. She said it was between 8 and 10. That would have been after she left the bar. Was it after you got home and found her missing?"
"I don't know. It was pretty late when I got home, but I don't know how late. How was this girl who might be Marisol acting?"
Manny said, embarrassed. "I didn't ask."
"You didn't ask?" Tina demanded.
"Don't yell at me. You go talk to her if you don't like the questions I asked."
They went to the Clifton. They had to hit an intercom button and ask the night manager to buzz them in. The lobby of the Clifton looked a lot like the lobby of the Sunrise, but there was an old wallpaper on the walls with a pattern of roses, bubbled and peeling and yellowish from years of cigarette smoke. The night manager, safe behind a window made of bars, was a short, plump older woman. She had curly red hair with gray roots, glasses, and eyes too bright green to be natural. She smoked a cigarette and had a gruff, "I don't take no shit" attitude.
"Look," she said when Tina started asking questions, "I don't normally give out information on tenants, even potential tenants. But your friend," she nodded towards Manny, "said this girl is missing and may be in trouble, and I believed her."
"Thank you," Tina said, though she thought the word sounded awkward as they came out of her mouth. Tina described Marisol as best she could, down to what Tina thought she remembered Marisol had been wearing when she went missing. The manager nodded and said,
"That's her, except I seem to remember she was wearing a jacket, maybe a gray one."
Tina thought. Among the dirty clothes scattered on the floor was an ugly old gray ski jacket that Joe sometimes wore when it was really cold. She'd never seen Marisol wear it. She hadn't thought to look through the clothes to see if any were missing.
"Did she say her name?"
The night manager shook her head no. "Just asked about getting a room. I told her what the deposit was, what the rules were. She asked if she could move in tonight. I told her if she had the deposit, she could. She said she'd be back, but she never came back."
"She said she was going to move in that night?"
"That's what she implied, anyway. I mean, she asked if she could move right in right away, and then she said she'd be back."
"What's the deposit?"
$50.
"Did she say why she was moving?"
The manager narrowed her eyes and shook her head.
"Did she say anything else?"
"Well," she took a puff on her cigarette, "she asked if she could have multiple people in the same room. I told her she would be crazy to try to sleep more than one person in a room that tiny. She persisted, though, saying she would pay the rent and follow all the rules. I said I guess she could try."
She shook her head slowly, as if considering some tragic folly. "That's all she said or asked?"
"As far as I remember."
"And how was she acting?"
"Nervous, I guess. Sort of distracted. Seemed like maybe she was on drugs, you know, the way she kept looking around."
"Or maybe she kept looking around because someone was after her and she was in danger," Tina said in an offended tone.
"Could be," the woman said neutrally. "And I seem to remember there was something in her hair, something clumpy."
"Blood?"
I don't know. I guess it might have been."
The night manager didn't have anything else interesting to say, so Tina and Manny went home. Tabitha and Joe were already asleep in the room when they got back. Tina woke them up, desperate to know if they had found anything, but they had no news. They complained that everyone out this time of night was a junkie or a crazy. Tina curled up on the couch, which still smelled a little bit like Marisol, and found she was too worried to sleep. Tina got out the wood-handled knife she had stolen from the thrift store. She opened up the little packet that the attractive Drake girl had given her. Inside the packet was tightly wrapped plastic wrap with something black inside it. As she started to unwrap the plastic, a wave of awful stench hit her. A while ago, they had hung around with this young runaway named Matt. Matt had gotten pushed down some stairs and had gotten a cut on his arm. Matt went on a week-long drug binge and had forgotten to take care of the wound at all. He'd gotten really sick and the wound had this awful, pungent odor, worse than rotting meat. That was what the black stuff in the plastic smelled like. Soon the others in the room smelled it. It even woke up Joe, who had already gone back to sleep. They started swearing and ordering Tina to leave the room. Tina quickly wrapped the plastic back up. She decided she wouldn't apply the poison now. She would only apply it once she figured out who hurt Marisol, if Marisol was indeed hurt, and was getting ready to go after them. She gave them cigarettes to smoke, to help cover up the smell. Manny turned the lights off. The only light in the room was street lights reflecting off the brick wall across from them and coming through the room's one small window. In the almost darkness, Manny stepped carefully past Tabitha, who was lying on the floor, and snuggled up next to Joe on the bed. Tina lay on Marisol's couch, her eyes open.
"I know an ambulance came by here," Tina said. "So whatever happened started in this room.
The wounded man went or was forced downstairs and an ambulance picked him up.
Tina, whined Tabitha, we're trying to sleep.
Tina continued, ignoring Tabitha.
But who did Marisol hurt? Did he make it to the hospital?
He didn't end up in the morgue. And then Marisol was looking for a room somewhere else. Or at least we think it was Marisol. Maybe it wasn't. What if someone came to the room, they had a fight, Marisol stabbed them, and then they went downstairs and got an ambulance? Then Marisol decided she needed to hide. Maybe she's hiding right now. And what about the room upstairs? What does that have to do with anything? Is it just a coincidence there's a creepy room that looks like it's used for killing people upstairs from us?
Shut up, please, Joe cried.
Tomorrow I'm going to the ambulance place, Tina said, her voice trailing off into silence. Find out who was in that fucking ambulance. Eventually, she slept.